This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled A Life Between Death and Rebirth in Relation to Cosmic Facts. 10 lectures given by Dr. Rudolf Steiner in Berlin, 1912-1913. The first lecture one is entitled A Life Between Death and Rebirth in Relation to Cosmic Facts, lecture one. It gives me great satisfaction that after a comparatively long period of time, I'm able to speak to you here again this evening. Those of you who were present at our performance at Munich this year, or who have learned in some other way what has been added to the contents of earlier performances through my new mystery drama, quote, The Guardian of the Threshold, close quote, will have seen what the attitude of the soul must be if it wishes to gain a true and complete idea of the many subjects included in anthroposophical life, or, shall we say, in occultism. In the course of the years, a great deal has been said about the beings whom we call luciferic and Ahrimanic. In The Guardian of the Threshold, we endeavored to show that the character of these beings can only be accurately learned when we approach them gradually from various aspects. We tried to show that it is not sufficient to form a simple idea about them, in terms of the usual definition dear to so many people, but that it is necessary to consider them from many different aspects and to observe how they intervene in human life. From this attempt of ours, you will also be able to acquire a feeling of what for many years has been the fundamental note of the lectures I have held here, a note which I have frequently ventured to describe in the words, quote, absolute truthfulness with respect to the spiritual worlds, close quote, or of deep earnestness with respect to these spiritual worlds. This has to be emphasized all the more at the present time, because the seriousness and dignity of what may be called anthroposophical endeavor, in the true sense of the word, is not yet very much recognized. If in the various lectures given this year, I have let one thing shine out above all others, it is that you should try to approach your anthroposophical work solely with this spirit of earnestness and truthfulness, and try to realize what this endeavor means in the universe, what it means to the evolution of humanity, and also what it means to the spiritual development of our age. It cannot be repeated too often that it is not possible to penetrate into anthroposophy with a few ideas, with a theory that may be summed up in a few sentences, or even with a program. One can only penetrate into what is truly anthroposophical with the whole life of the soul. Life, however, is a process of becoming. It is development. If someone were to raise the objection that he cannot join an anthroposophical movement if the demand for, in quotes, development is at once made of him, and if he is told that he can only gradually penetrate into the depths of what is truly called anthroposophy, and that therefore he cannot decide to enter what he ought only gradually to develop into, we must reply to this. Before a person can rise to the zenith of a development, he must already possess in his heart and soul that which has led the whole of humanity to strive after such a development. He must possess the sense for truth. All he need do is to devote himself without prejudice to this sense for truth, with the will for truth, not with the will for the vanity of a theory, not with the will for the pride of a program, but with the will for the truth which lies deep within the soul, if not led astray by all kinds of prejudices. We perceive the truth where it is honestly pursued. Therefore it is possible for a person to make an honest criticism of the truth, even if he only takes the first steps toward its attainment. This does not exclude the fact that the principal thing for him is to enter vividly into the whole development of anthroposophical endeavor. In our age, there is really a great deal that leads a human being astray with respect to the natural feeling for truth, which in an ordinary way exists in his soul. And in the course of years, I have often referred to such occasions for error, and need not do so again today. I have said this because I should like to emphasize the fact that it is always necessary even though we may already know one thing or another from occult science, to approach these matters from fresh aspects, from fresh points of view, and to consider them again and again. We are supported in this, to a certain extent, by what we find in the field of anthroposophy regarding the four Gospels. This autumn we concluded our observations on the several Gospels with a course of lectures in Basel on the Gospel of St. Mark. As there are four Gospels, we may see in this fact a model of how to approach the great truths of existence from different sides. Each Gospel provides an opportunity to consider the mystery of Golgotha from a different aspect, and to a certain extent we can only know something about this mystery when we consider it from the four different aspects provided by the four Gospels. What has been the spirit of our studies for the last 10 or 12 years with respect to this one point? Those of you who wish to see clearly on this matter need only read my book titled Christianity as Mystical Fact. The contents of this book were given in the form of lectures before the founding of the German section of the Theosophical Society. One who seriously studies this book will find that all those things are contained in it which have since been touched upon in connection with the various Gospels, that the whole mystery of Golgotha, as we have lectured upon it during these years, is already contained in this book. Nothing, however, would be more unjustified than to think that when a person knows the contents of this book, he also has a conception, adequate for the present day, of the mystery of Golgotha. To this end, it has been also necessary to give all the lectures that have been given since the book appeared. The lectures run on the same lines and develop in an ordinary manner from this embryo of our spiritual observations. And at no point do they contradict what is contained in the book Christianity as Mystical Fact. We were able to open up ever fresh ways of considering the mystery of Golgotha, and thereby to penetrate more and more deeply into it. In this way we sought to place a direct living into the spiritual facts, in the place of ideas, theories, and programs. Truly, although in all this there has always been the feeling of something missing, namely, that it is impossible always to give all that is necessary, still this absence is really connected with something that cannot be altered on the physical plane. It is connected with the question of time. It is impossible at one particular time to give all that may be said. Therefore, one thing has always been demanded of you. You have been asked to have patience and to wait and see how these things gradually develop. This is an indication also of how the things which I have to say to you during the coming winter should be accepted. In recent years, we have often spoken of the life between death and rebirth, and we shall deal principally with the subject again in the following lectures, because during the course of this last summer and autumn, my task has been to investigate spiritually into this realm afresh, and to open up a point of view which could not be touched upon before. Only now can we begin to consider many things that reveal the profound moral significance of the supersensible truths regarding this realm. In addition to all the other requirements to which brief reference has just been made, there is another which also has always been made in our movement, one which in our age of pride and vanity wounds so many to the heart. But as we cannot be kept back by such a fact from the earnestness and truthfulness we owe our movement, this requirement must be made. It is that we shall learn to work thoroughly and seriously, and really strive to penetrate deeply into what is brought from the spiritual worlds. For a number of years, the relation of human beings living on the physical plane to the spiritual worlds has become different from what it was throughout almost the whole of the 19th century. Until the last third of the 19th century, there was little access to the spiritual worlds. I have referred to this before. In accordance with the necessities of human evolution, very little came into the human soul from the spiritual worlds. We are now living, however, in an age when the soul need only be receptive, it need only be devoted and prepared, in order that the revelations from the spiritual worlds may come to it. Individual souls will become more and more receptive, and for them the incoming of spiritual knowledge will be a fact because they are aware of their mission in this age. Hence the further demand is made on anthroposophists that they will not close themselves to what is able to flow into their souls from the spiritual worlds at the present time. Before I enter upon the principal theme of our lectures, I should like to draw your attention to two peculiarities of spiritual life which ought especially to be noticed. A human being experiences the facts of the spiritual world between death and rebirth in a very definite manner. He experiences them also through initiation. He experiences them if he has prepared his soul even during his life in the physical body, and he has thus a share in the spiritual worlds. We have often spoken of this, and we are justified in saying that that which takes place between death and rebirth, which is also a life in the spiritual world, can be seen through initiation. It is necessary to notice two things which are really the result of our previous statements and belong not only to the experience of the spiritual worlds, but also to the proper understanding of what is given from the spiritual worlds. We have often laid stress upon the fact that everything looks different in the spiritual worlds from what it does here in the physical world, and that when the soul enters into the spiritual worlds, it finds itself in a sphere in which it has to become accustomed to a great deal that is exactly opposite to the things of the physical world. We may mention one thing. Here on the physical plane, if something is to come about through us in the physical world, we human beings have to be active. We have to use our hands. We have to move, to carry our physical body from one place to another. Thus, in order that something may come about through us in the physical world, an actual setting to work on these matters is necessary. For the spiritual worlds, exactly the opposite is necessary. I am speaking of the present era. That which is to come about through us in the spiritual world must come about through our quietness, our peace of mind. In the spiritual world, a quiet, quote, being able to wait, close quote, for events corresponds to the busy activity on the physical plane. The less we bestir ourselves on the physical plane, the less takes place through us. The more we bestir ourselves, the more we accomplish. On the other hand, the quieter we are in our soul, and the more we renounce all inward activity, the more can come about through us in the spiritual world. In order that something may come to pass through us in the spiritual world, it is necessary that we should be able to consider what does come to pass as something given us by grace, something with which we are blessed, which approaches us because we merit it through our peace of mind. Let me give an example. I have often mentioned here that to one who possesses spiritual knowledge, the year 1899 was important. It was the end of a 5,000-year cycle in the history of humanity, the end of the so-called smaller Kali Yuga. Since that year, the souls of men have been obliged to allow the spiritual to approach them differently from what it did before that time. I will give you a concrete example. About the end of the 12th century, a man named Norbert founded an order in the West. Before the idea came to him to found this order, Norbert was a passionate, easygoing man, full of love of the world. One day something very remarkable happened to him. He was struck by lightning. It did not kill him, but it changed his whole being. There are many examples such as this in the evolution of humanity. The man was entirely changed. The way in which his four principles, physical body, etheric body, astral body, and ego, were united, was changed through penetration by the power that was in the lightning. He then founded the order in question. and although this order, like so many others, did not realize what its founder wished, it did, in many respects, a great deal of good at that time. It has often happened that something has come about, in quotes, by chance, as the man of the present day says, but that was not by chance. It was an event that was brought about in the karma of the world. This man was chosen to do something special, and therefore the conditions had to be produced in his body so that he could accomplish it. This outer event was necessary. This more external influence had to be exercised. The year 1899 was a turning point. Since that year, such influences have to approach souls in a purely inward manner. They cannot come from outside in such a striking way. It is not as if a sudden transformation has to come, but what will act upon human souls from the present time onward will work in a more and more inward manner. You will remember that I have said that Christian Rosenkreutz could act on any human soul he wished to call, in quotes, and that this is an inward call. Before 1899, these calls had to be brought about through outer events. Since then, they have been and will become more and more inward. The intercourse of human souls with the higher hierarchies will become more and more inward. And the human being will have to exert himself more and more to maintain this intercourse through the highest and most interior forces of his soul. What I have just described to you as a turning point in the life of the physical plane corresponds in the spiritual world with much that has taken place between the beings of the higher hierarchies. And this is visible to one who can see into the spiritual worlds. Things which the beings in the higher worlds have to do among themselves came about in quite a special way at that time. There is one peculiarity with respect to this turning point. The beings who in the spiritual world had to bring Kali Yuga to an end needed something from our earth, something that took place on our earth. It was necessary for them that in certain souls who were ripe for it, there should now be knowledge of these things, that ideas regarding this revolution should be in the souls of men. For just as man on the physical plane has need of a brain in order that he may be conscious, the beings of the higher hierarchies may need of human thoughts in which their deeds can be reflected. The human world is necessary to the spiritual world. It works with it and must be there. There has to be proper cooperation between them. Those who were ready at that time, or who are ready now to cooperate in these things from the human side, might not, nor may they now, carry on propaganda as regards that which is to be brought about in the spiritual world, as is customary on the physical plane. We do not help the spirits of the higher hierarchies by being busy, as it were, on the physical plane, but by first understanding what is to come to pass, and then by applying ourselves devotedly to this in the supersensible worlds with entire peace of mind and in the most absolute one-pointedness of soul life. Therefore, what we are able to contribute is the quietude we can maintain, the frame of mind we are able to acquire in order to await this favor, this grace by which we may see. We can therefore say, paradoxical as it may sound, our activities in the higher worlds depend upon the peace of our minds. The more peaceful we are able to become, the more can come to pass through us regarding the facts of the higher worlds. Hence it is necessary that those who would participate in a spiritual movement should really acquire this frame of mind, this peace of mind. Especially it is to be desired that those in the anthroposophical movement should strive for this tranquility of mind, this conscious, grace-filled attitude toward the higher worlds. Among the various activities of man on the physical plane, similar things can only be found in the realm of art, or where there is a true striving for knowledge for the advancement of a spiritual movement. Most assuredly, an artist will not produce the best he is capable of if he wants to be always busy and get on with his work. But he will produce his best if he is in a position to await the moment of grace and to be quiet even when the Spirit does not speak to him. One who wishes to construct a higher knowledge with the ideas he already possesses will certainly not succeed. It is only attained by one who can quietly wait when a question or a problem regarding the world comes up, who says resignedly, quote, "I must wait until the answer comes to me, like a ray of light from the spiritual world," close quote. Those who run from one person to another, seeking to convince them as soon as possible that this spiritual movement is the only right one, are certainly not working within our spiritual movement in the right way. They should be able to wait until souls approach, after they have felt within themselves the impulse to seek the truths of the spiritual world. Such is the position as regards man's actions, toward that which shines down into our physical world, and especially as regards all that he can do in the spiritual world. We might say that in the spiritual realm, the most practical things depend very much upon the acquirement of a certain condition of repose. I should like to draw your attention to one thing more, to the psycho-spiritual method of healing. In spiritual healing, the chief thing does not consist in performing certain movements or actions. These have to be performed, but only as a preparation. The object of them is to bring about repose and balance. What is outwardly visible in a case of spiritual healing is but the preparation for what the spiritual healer does. The principal thing is what finally takes place. It is somewhat as if we had a pair of scales in front of us. First we place on one scale something we wish to weigh, then on the other scale we place a weight that sets the beam of the scale in motion to one side and then to the other. But we can only tell the weight when balance is attained. The case is similar as regards activity in the spiritual world, but as regards perception it is different. How does perception come about in our everyday life on the physical plane? Everyone knows that, with the exception of certain domains of the physical plane, things come to us. Every moment we get fresh impressions. Only in exceptional circumstances do we hunt for impressions and bring to objects that which objects usually bring to us. And this is the search for knowledge. As regards spiritual knowledge, however, we ourselves have to place before our soul all that is to come before it. While all we accomplish, all that happens through us in the spiritual world, takes place through our being absolutely quiet, we have to be constantly active if we really wish to know something in the spiritual world. With this is connected the fact that what we cultivate here of true knowledge seems too inconvenient for many who would like to be anthroposophists. They say, quote, "When we join you, we have first to learn everything. We have first to ponder over everything, work at everything," close quote. Without this, the understanding of the spiritual world cannot be gained. The mind has to be exercised powerfully. Things have to be looked at from different points of view. This is essential. The conceptions we wish to acquire concerning the higher worlds have first to be obtained by quiet, patient work. In the physical world, if we want to make a table, we have to do it by active work. But in the spiritual world, if we want to produce something, we have to develop the kind of repose necessary before anything can take place. And when something does take place, it comes forth from the dim twilight. If we wish to know something, on the other hand, we have first to construct the inspirations through great exertion. In order to gain knowledge, work is necessary. An inwardly active frame of mind, an advance from inspiration to inspiration, from imagination to imagination, from intuition to intuition. We have to construct everything, and nothing comes before us that we do not ourselves bring there when seeking knowledge. Thus the things of the spiritual world are the exact opposite of all that is correct in the physical world. I had to mention this so that we might be clear as to how these matters may first be found and then understood, but we shall have to deal further with these things. In these lectures, I shall not touch so much upon Kamaloka, the life immediately after death. You already know the essentials of that, but we shall consider from fresh points of view the periods after death which follow the life in Kamaloka. It is necessary, in the first place, that we should refer to the peculiarity of our life there. You know that a person has what we might call imaginative life as the first stage of higher knowledge. We might also call it the life in true, in real visions. In the physical world, we are surrounded by colors, sounds, perfumes. We have sensations of taste. We have ideas which we form with our intellect. In the spiritual world, we are at first surrounded by imaginations, which may also be called visions, although we must clearly understand that if these imaginations or visions are correct in the spiritual sense, they do not represent dreams, but realities. Let us take a definite case. After a person has passed through the portal of death, he meets those who have died before him, those who were with him in a certain way during life. In the period between death and rebirth, we are really together with those who belong to us. Just as we perceive objects in the physical world by seeing their colors, hearing their sounds, etc., so after death we are surrounded, I may say this by way of comparison, by a cloud of visions. Everything around us is vision. We ourselves are vision. Just as here we are flesh and blood, there we are vision. This vision, however, is not a dream. We know that it is reality. When we meet one who has died, and who we knew formerly, he also is vision. He is enclosed, as it were, in the visionary cloud. But just as on the physical plane we know that the color red comes from a red rose, on the spiritual plane we know that the vision comes from a spiritual being who has passed through the portal of death before us. Now comes a peculiarity which we have to notice carefully, a peculiarity which is realized by everyone who experiences this period after death. Here on the physical plane it may be the case that there is a person who, according to all appearances, we ought really to love, and who, as we discover afterward, we have not loved enough. We have deprived him of love. Let us take this example, that we have deprived a person of love, or made him suffer in some other way. Then, if we are not too hard-hearted, we may have the feeling or the idea, I must make that good. And when this feeling comes, it is possible for us to make it good. To a certain extent, we are able to work further on the conditions that surrounded us on the physical plane, but we cannot do this in the first period after the time in Kamaloka, the period of which we are now speaking. When we then confront a person, from the way in which we perceive him, we may quite well know that we have caused him such and such a sorrow, or deprived him of the love that we owed him. We may also resolve to make this good, but we cannot actually do it. During this period, we can only have the relationship to this person, which was already formed before death. We can perceive him, but we are unable at first to do anything. We are unable at first to repair anything. That is to say, in this visionary world, which envelops us like a cloud, we cannot change anything. We see it, but we cannot change it. The relationship we have had toward a person who has died before us remains. This is also very often one of the more painful experiences of initiation. The pupil then experiences a great deal respecting his relation to the physical world, and he truly beholds it in a deeper way than he does with his eyes or with his intellect. He can see it through and through, but he cannot directly change it. And this constitutes the pain of spiritual knowledge. It constitutes the martyrdom of spiritual knowledge. Insofar as this knowledge relates to our own life, insofar as it is self-knowledge. It is the same after death. After death, people live in relationship to those with whom they have been connected in some way in life, and these relationships, which to a certain extent are permanent, continue as they were. When this fact came recently before my spiritual eyes, very forcibly, I was reminded of something. In my life, I have had a great deal to do with the works of Homer, and I have tried to understand many things in Homer's poems. On this occasion, I was reminded of a passage in which Homer speaks of the realm in which man lives after death, which he calls, quote, the kingdom of the shades, in which no change is possible, close quote. The Greeks indicated the fact that Homer was clairvoyant by referring to him as blind Homer. Here again I became aware of many things in the great poems and revelations that have appeared in the history of humanity, which we only know properly when they are brought forth from the depths of spiritual knowledge. Much of the knowledge given to humanity will depend upon whether people see their great ancestors in a new light, in the light of true understanding. Those great ones who were blessed by the spiritual light shining into their souls. How deeply a sensitive soul is touched when it comes across such a statement as the following, which says, quote, this ancient seer could only write this passage because the truth of the spiritual world shone into his soul. Close quote. Here begins true piety toward the divine spiritual forces which govern the world and dwell in the hearts and minds of men. Here we first observe with true piety what takes place in the world for its further progress and development. There is a great deal in what was said by those who were gifted as Homer was gifted, which is, in quotes, true in the deepest and most spiritual sense. But this truth, which in the past could be recognized directly by ancient dim clairvoyance, has now been lost, and it has to be regained on the path of spiritual knowledge. In order to confirm this example of the understanding of what has been given to humanity by its creative geniuses, I should like on this occasion to mention something else. This was a truth which I have even resisted when it came into my mind, a truth which seemed paradoxical to me, but which, when it presented itself directly to me, I had from an inner necessity to recognize as true. What I had then to work at in the spiritual world was connected with certain works of art. Among them was the result of previous studies, but they now came before my soul in this way for the first time. What I now tell you is connected with the tombs of the Medici in Florence and the chapel built and arranged by Michelangelo. Two of the Medicis, of whom we need not now speak further, were to be immortalized there in sculpture, but Michelangelo added four so-called allegorical figures, which, in accordance with his suggestion, were called morning and evening, day and night. Day and night at the foot of one Medici statue, morning and evening at the foot of the other. Now, even though we may not have particularly good copies of these, you will easily be able, when you look at them, to confirm what I shall now say regarding these four allegorical figures. I shall commence with the most famous one, that of night. In the descriptions usually given in guidebooks, you may read that the peculiar positions of the limbs chosen by Michelangelo for the recumbent figure of night are unnatural, because a person would be unable to sleep in such a position, so that this figure need not be considered as a particularly good symbolical expression for night. I will give you now a different view. Let us suppose that we are observing this allegorical figure of night with occult vision. We then say, when a human being is asleep, his ego and astral body are out of the physical and etheric bodies. It is conceivable that someone might then think out a particular pose of the limbs that would be most in keeping with the position of the etheric body when the astral body and the ego are not in it. When we go about during the day, we assume one pose or another through the astral body and ego being within the physical and etheric bodies. But at night, the astral body and ego are outside, and the etheric body alone is in the physical body. It develops its own activity. And this yields a certain pose which gives the impression that there is no more fitting attitude for the free activity of the etheric body than the one Michelangelo has portrayed in his night, an attitude so precise that it cannot be pictured better or more exactly than by the figure which here represents the position of the etheric body. Let us now pass on to the other figure, that of day, of which the following may be said. Suppose that we could cause a person to keep his etheric life and his astral life quiet, as far as this is possible, so that the ego is mainly active and produces a position, and that we search for the most fitting pose for the ego. We could then find nothing better than the pose portrayed by Michelangelo in his day. These positions are therefore not allegorical, but they are taken directly and quite realistically from life. The artist has thus imprinted in the evolution of humanity, in characters that are relatively permanent, quote, "This is the pose which best expresses the activity of the ego, and this is the pose which best expresses the activity of the etheric body," close quote. Now let us observe the other figures. Let us take evening first. If we think of the withdrawal of the etheric body in the case of a particularly well-formed human being, if we think of the relaxation of the physical body, which comes also at death, if we think not of death, but of the withdrawal of the three principles, etheric body, astral body, and ego, and search for the position that the physical body then takes, we have the pose of this allegorical figure, evening. If we wish to express the inner activity of the astral body during a diminished activity of the etheric body and ego, the accurate pose is that given by Michelangelo in his morning. So on the one hand, we find expressed the activities of the etheric body and the ego, and on the other, those of the physical body and the astral body. As already mentioned, at first I strove against this, but the more minutely these things are gone into, the more one finds that they are correct. In this matter, I wish to do nothing more than point out how the artist has worked from the spiritual world. I admit that Michelangelo did this more or less unconsciously, but in spite of this, what else is it than a shining forth of the spiritual world into the physical world? Occultism contributes not to the destruction, but to the enrichment of works of art, and in the future a great deal of what is now looked upon as art will no longer be considered such. Some people will perhaps be disillusioned, but the truth will gain thereby. I can quite well understand the inner foundation of the legend which has arisen concerning the most perfect of these figures, which is that when Michelangelo was alone in Florence with his knight in the Medici chapel, he was able to make it stand up so that it walked about. I will not go further into this. But when we know that this figure expresses the activity of the life body, we see the significance of the legend, for it is indeed there. This is the case with many geniuses, Homer among others. Homer describes the spiritual world as a realm of shades in which there can be no change. When we observe conditions in the life after Kamaloka, we get a new understanding of the works of this divinely gifted man, and many other things will be enriched through anthroposophy in a similar manner. On the other hand, these are not the chief things in life. The principal things in life are that the relationships between human beings are continually changing. When a person confronts another human being so that he perceives the spiritual in him, his attitude toward him is entirely different from that which he has if he thinks that those forces only are active in the man which a materialistic view of the world supposes. Each human soul must be to us a sacred riddle, and it can only be so to our real feelings and perceptions when we have something in our soul which can throw a spiritual light upon the other soul. Only by going deeply into cosmic secrets, with which human secrets are connected, do we come to know human nature? Do we learn to recognize whom we are confronting when a human being stands before us? We then learn, above all, to silence the prejudice we formerly had toward a person, and we learn to feel and to know his real true side. The most important light that spiritual science can give is the one that will illumine the human soul. True social love, the right feeling of love which ought to exist between human beings, will come into the world as the fruit of true spiritual knowledge. This can only be looked upon as a future product, as a fruit whose growth and welfare we can only cultivate through spiritual knowledge. When Schopenhauer said, quote, "To preach morals is easy, to give them a foundation is difficult," close quote, he expressed a true feeling, for it is really not very difficult to devise moral axioms. Neither is it difficult to preach moral sermons. But the important thing is to grasp the human soul in which spiritual knowledge germinates, in which it grows of itself into true morals that can be a support to human life. The attitude of each one of us toward spiritual knowledge will sow in us seed for the true human morals of the future. The morals of the future will be built upon spiritual knowledge. They must either be built up in this way, or they have no foundation at all. It is necessary, in true love of accuracy, that we should acknowledge this and should enter deeply into the actual life and activity of anthroposophy. And above all, bear in mind what was said at the beginning of this lecture, namely that action in the spiritual world presupposes peace of mind, the proving oneself worthy of being blessed. Knowledge presupposes activity. From this you will understand that in the period between death and rebirth, when we confront another being, we are able to recognize, through the activity we then develop, whether we have withheld love from him, or whether we have done something to him which we ought not to have done. At this period of time, we cannot yet develop the quiet necessary to correct this, the necessary stillness of the feelings in the soul. In the course of this winter's lectures, I shall describe the period between death and rebirth, when, in the natural course of that life, it happens that a person can bring about the conditions whereby this can be changed, that is, when he can bring about a sort of reconstruction of his karma. We must keep the period we have just been considering apart in our minds from those that follow, which have different tasks. With these I shall deal later on. We may, however, say that there are certain conditions under which a man may live through his life after death in a more favorable or a less favorable manner. If we compare two people, or various people, after death, the way they live just after life in Kamaloka depends upon the moral constitution they have had upon the earth. People who on the earth have manifested good moral qualities have the most favorable conditions in the period after Kamaloka. Those who have manifested defective moral qualities have bad conditions. I might give a formula for the manner in which this is expressed in the life after death, a formula which, as our words are coined for the physical world and not for the spiritual world, cannot be quite exact. We can only try to make it as exact as possible. We may say that through a moral constitution of our soul, we become sociable spirits who have friendly relations with other spirits, that is, with human spirits or with the spirits of the higher hierarchies, in the period we have mentioned. Through a defective moral constitution of our soul, we become not sociable, but solitary spirits, spirits who are only able to get out of the cloud of their vision with very great difficulty. This is an essential cause of sorrow after death, feeling oneself as a solitary spirit, as a spiritual hermit, while an essential characteristic of companionship is to find the connection with what is necessary for us, with what we need. It takes a very long time in the life after death to live through this sphere, which in occultism is called the sphere of Mercury. Naturally, The moral feeling of the soul still exercises an influence in the next sphere, but new conditions are added. And for this sphere, the Venus sphere, the religious feelings of the soul are most important. People with a religious frame of mind become sociable beings in this period, irrespective of the faith to which they belonged. On the other hand, spirits who are not religiously inclined condemn themselves in this sphere to a spiritual restriction. They have to creep into themselves. Although it may seem paradoxical, I cannot do otherwise than say that those who have a predominantly materialistic frame of mind and who fume against religious life have to become spiritual hermits. Each one of them is confined, as it were, in his cell. It is not an ironical simile, but a truth, when I say that all those who now uphold a monistic religion, that is, the opposite of religion, are especially closely shut up in prison. They absolutely cannot find one another. In this way, the errors and mistakes made by the soul in earthly life are corrected. On the physical plane, errors and mistakes correct themselves. But in the life between death and rebirth, errors and mistakes signify facts. What we think now means a fact in our life between death and rebirth. Thinking signifies a fact also in initiation. In initiation, a mistaken thought, if one is really able to perceive it, stands there not only in all its ugliness, but with all the destructive powers it contains. Truly, people would soon turn away from many of the thoughts that are spread abroad in various agitatory movements if they only had some notion of what they mean as facts, as destructive facts. This also belongs to the martyrdom of initiation, that thoughts group themselves around us and stand there, I might say, like solidified frozen masses which we cannot move as long as we are outside the body. If we have formed a wrong thought and then leave the body, it exists, and we cannot then change it. To do this, we must first go back into the body. The memory of it remains, but even the initiate can only correct it when in the physical body. There it stands like a mountain, and the seriousness of the life of actual facts can only be brought home to us in this way. From this you will understand the necessity of returning to the physical body to make certain karmic compensations. We see our mistakes in our life between death and rebirth, but we have to correct them when in the physical body. In a subsequent life, that which took place in the previous one is balanced. It stands before us and has to be recognized in all its strength and in all its faultiness, and at first it is unchangeable, like all the things in the spiritual realm, even according to Homer's statement. The knowledge we gain of the spiritual world ought to enter into our souls and to become feeling, and it will then enable us to look upon life in a new way. A monistic Sunday sermon may contain a great many moral axioms, but people will change very little through this, as time will show. Because of the way in which these things are said, the ideas are not fitted really to lay hold of the human soul. The real strength of ideas is necessary for this, and real strength is contained in the knowledge that throughout a certain period in life, after death, we see directly in front of us the content of our karma. We see what our karma is burdened with, but it remains. We cannot now alter it. We can only enter into it more deeply and unite it fully with our nature. Our feelings are so affected by these ideas that we are able to look upon life in the right way. Then follows all that is necessary for the furtherance of life, if humanity is really to progress to the goal placed before it in the way intended by those beings who exercise the spiritual guidance of man in accordance with the great spiritual leader of humanity. The end of Lecture 1.